All right, you're not too old for a sing-along, are you? Yeah, well, let's see.
Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is rock journalist par excellence, Jim Sullivan. And we're talking about his new book, Backstage and Beyond, 45 Years of Classic Rock Chants and Rants, Volume 1. Jim, welcome to the show. It's such a pleasure to talk to you about this book.
Well, thank you very much.
I love this book. First of all, I want to say that Volume 2 is going to be out when? October?
Volume 2 is October 19th.
Now, what's the difference between the two of them?
The first book tends to focus on artists who started their career in the 50s through the early mid-70s. The second book focuses on artists who started in the mid-70s onward. So in a rough sense of it, that would be the punk, post-punk, new wave
era. I'm psyched about that.
Yeah.
Now, I'm going to give you a big tip of the hat for referring to the grassroots in your preface. I'm that old that I know who the grassroots are.
Live for today. Yeah, that's right. It's funny. I saw them at a club in Sarasota many years ago, and I almost went kind of as a goof, thinking, oh, my God, the grassroots, really, still?
Oh, come on.
No. I mean, yeah, that's a little bit. Yeah, I was in my punk face, right? Do I really want to see the grassroots? And I did, and they were terrific. It was so much fun, and all of that brought back great feelings to me. And that song just kept in my brain, you know?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
If you live through it, you remember it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you credit or blame Slade for your career. You have to explain that.
They were the first band I interviewed. And I was in college. I brought down a reel-to-reel tape deck to the Bangor Auditorium, 1975. And what happened was I had no credentials, really, but I knew the promoter. He ushered me backstage. Credit to Andrew Gavatas for that. And Slade was very welcoming, really, to talk to probably anybody, but especially somebody who knew the band and was a fan of the band. And I don't think they really cared what it was for. And what it was for, really, was for a radio show that I did at the college radio station. I was going to edit, and I did. I edited a tape of the interview and played music and all that. And that was really even before I started to write. But it was the impetus of me, you know, if you will, getting behind the closed doors and meeting with, if you will, rock stars. They were not stars in the United States, but big stars in England. And in my head, they were certainly big stars because I really loved the band. But it wasn't just the idea that I met them. It was the idea that they welcomed me into the fold and treated me really like mates. And, you know, we had a few beers. We shared some jokes. I knew the music and could ask fairly intelligent questions about it. And it was just the most welcoming thing I can think of in terms of a career, if you will. Not that I knew that was going to happen. But I felt very comfortable in that setting. And that put me on a good place to continue to do that kind of thing.
Jim, the thing that I found in these interviews that was, these pieces, I shouldn't say they're sections of interviews, is that you've interviewed some of these artists several times over the length of their career, and you sort of get a interesting long view of what they're like. Specifically, I'm thinking of Ian Hunter and Mott the Hoople. That was a really interesting interview piece. He's at towards the end of his career, and it's really fascinating what he had to say.
Yeah, I mean, Mott the Hoople and then Ian Solo have been people that, you know, I was fans of really since All the Young Dudes came upon my world. And then I went back to the earlier albums and forward and et cetera. And in covering him, and then later the Mott the Hoople reunion and all that. There was an easy camaraderie between us, I think. And the knowledge that I brought to it, i.e. being a fan and having written about them over the years, allowed me to well, get to a good place, I guess. And there was a level of trust between us, I think, and being candid. And he's very candid as a songwriter, writing about the ups and downs of his life, the rock and roll world.
Well, he considers rock and roll a loser's game. That's what he said.
Say it again, I'm sorry.
He considers rock and roll a loser's game.
Well, right. That's one of the lines is that. But then again, it's the game he plays.
Yeah.
You know?
Yep. Yep.
So I mean, there's that contrast there. And I mean, I think you know he's one of the maybe few rockers who really not only sees the ups and downs of the business but sings about it. I think a lot of people would admit there are real downsides as well as the upsides. But Ian put that into song fairly often, and I think gave anybody as accurate a picture of what that world is like more than anybody. He did that also in his book, Diary of a Rockstar.
Yeah.
And I think that carries through in the chapter that I wrote about him and the various years that I talked to him. And, you know, keep in mind, too, he was an older rocker, if you will. I mean, when fame hit, he was, I believe, in his mid-late 30s.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, a good generation or so above when fame, if it does hit, hits for most artists, I think.
It was found in every one of your pieces, I learned something new, at least one thing, if not more. What I learned about the Ian Hunter Mott the Hoople piece is that Bowie offered him Suffragette City, and then he didn't think it was for them.
Right. Right, exactly. Yep. So, I mean, by happenstance or fate, whatever you want to call it, it became All the Young Dudes. And that became the song that basically saved the band.
I know. People may not realize that Bowie wrote that and then gave that to Ian Hunter.
Yeah. Well,
and it's Bowie, a quintessential Bowie. When you know that, you know it's a Bowie song.
Yeah, yeah, you do. And, of course, you know, Bowie did it in years later in concert.
Yeah.
And, you know, great song for him, great song for Mott the Hoople. And, you know, it was very much a song of the times. I think, you know, Ian knows that they were very fortunate for that liaison with Bowie, the friendship they had. And I think, you know, I mean, it's indicative, actually, too, of, you know, what Bowie was all about as well. I mean, he supported artists who he admired. And whether or not they had achieved any success at all, Bowie was, you know, he did what he could to help them, including the covers album that Bowie did, Pinups, back in whatever
right.
it was, 71, 72, can't remember. You know, where he's picking up, you know, a Pink Floyd song or you know, these things that may have fallen by the wayside, and yet he's giving a boost to these artists who inspired him when he was younger and also getting them a paycheck.
And let's move to David Bowie. I think the piece on David Bowie is great, just amazing. I have to say, though, he's the only artist, rock artist, who would refer to Francis Picabia, the Dadaist and Surrealist artist, in talking to you. I mean, I can't imagine another rocker doing that.
No, same here.
I mean, that was an amazing piece that you wrote about him, and you talked about so many things. You wanted to read a section from your book. Do you want to read a section from Bowie?
Yeah, sure. And I mean, that was one of the sections I thought would be interesting. The
concept. Yeah, thing. Yeah.
I'll just start with where that goes. I'll start this way. You might think he would expect a question, but he pauses and issues a before formulating a response. And, of course, when he does, it's quite a discourse. The question, a word frequently applied to your career, has been chameleon-like for all the musical changes and image shifts you've undergone. Do you agree with that assessment? Do you see yourself as a chameleon? The answer. I think a painter who fell into that category was Picabia, mentioning the French artist who began as a post-impressionist, later embraced cubism, futurism, Dada, and surrealism. He had a very hard time being taken seriously as an artist because he changed so rapidly. There we go. I'm sorry. Lost my place. Rapidly and continually throughout his career. And if you aren't seen as a craftsman who will stick to your so-called guns, I think you unfortunately start falling into the realm of dilettante. And I got plagued with that for a while. I think I probably always will. But I can't change my focus. My focus is very short-lived. I'll fool around with a side of art or a side of music or whatever, and then my attention is not there anymore. I don't wish to take it any further. I've done what I want to do with it, and then I move on. This just happens to be the kind of artist I am. I'm not sure whether that means chameleon. It just means that there are so many aspects of music that are interesting to me. It really is fun playing in there like a big playground.
It's fascinating because he's saying that none of it was calculated.
Right. I mean, and that's the thing. People obviously accuse him of calculating this and calculating that. And, you know, this is something he, you know, says, no, not really. You know, certainly he understands where that comes from. And, you know, he just said, this is one of the, another bit from the book. He said, when we were talking about his history and perception of what he did, he said, well, I'm not without luggage. He said with a chuckle, admitting what may be obvious, and he's had to groan over more than a few things he said and done in the past quarter century in the public eye. But he adds, an upside is perhaps that some of that luggage makes travel easier. Plus, I have this. I don't know, this unquenchable enthusiasm, and I probably drive people around me mad with my enthusiasm. And I asked him this, an English interviewer had tossed him a very self-analytical question, and Bowie took the bait and described himself as a populist and a postmodern Buddhist surfing my way through the chaos of the 20th century. And then when I brought that up to him, he just laughed. He said, oh, pretentious? Moi? and then he followed up with this. He said, look, I'm not sure what to do with these things. He said, sighing. Of that quote in particular and his proclivity in general for making pronouncements and expounding philosophically. I like dreaming them up, but they come back at me. Some people get them as what they are, which is poking fun at myself, and other people think that's kind of what I really think. And I'm not sure which side to go on because I half believe it's true. That's the trouble.
There are certain artists in this book that you really need to bring your A game. To talk, like you're having another level of conversation. Bowie's definitely one of them. Eno is another one where you really need to bring your A game.
You do. You know, and I mean, I think in general, I mean, not to, you know, thump my own chest here, but I mean, I did a lot of prep before these interviews. And I mean, not prep in the sense that I this was music I had to learn or know when I hadn't known before. I'd known the music, but I dug deeper, read a lot, and tried to get, for Eno and for everybody really, tried to get on the wavelength that I thought would make some sense to talk with them, whether it was you know, serious and analytical or more humorous or some combination of the two. And, you know, and certainly with Eno, the man has done so much in so many different fields, and he's, I mean, obviously one of the more intelligent rock people out there, and he's quite a theorist. So in doing these interviews, I was never quite sure where he was coming from that day.
Yeah.
I knew wherever he was coming from, he sure meant it, and he put a lot of thought into what he said. So even when he's speaking extemporaneously, it's like a written passage that's been edited, you know? And, he sure had a lot of good things to say and a lot of critical things to say and a lot of humorous things to say about his career. And I remember one of the things I asked him was about his success as an artist, not as a producer. As a producer, he was extremely successful, as we all know, with U2 and many others. But as an artist, and, you know, in my book, his rock albums, those first four were just terrific. And I said, so, you know, those you've done pretty well with those. And he kind of laughed and said, well, not as well as you might think, because he said, more people know me for the ambient music that I do than the rock stuff that I do. And, you know, that was probably true, too. He created more or less the ambient school of music.
That's right.
And put out a number of albums in that realm and encouraged others to do so, collaborated with others doing so. So he had these disparate sides to himself. You know, one very raucous and disruptive and saucy and in love with wordplay and juxtaposition. And the other very much into sort of melancholy, calm music that, as he said, was meant to be as unobtrusive as it was listenable.
Well, he also started working with visual art that was very weird. It would have his music in the background, but it continued to morph. So there would be these abstract paintings that continue to evolve, and they would be available on DVDs or whatever. And that's what he became more known for it later on, like right now. He's known as a visual artist just as much as an auditory artist.
Right, exactly. I remember seeing one of the installations he did at the Institute of Contemporary Art at Boston. And yet, like you said, I mean, it's, you know, a long loop of very slow images. I think, if I'm not mistaken, some of those are pretty erotic, too.
Yep.
And the music kind of just very gradually moving, shifting. And the combination of the two, you know, put you in kind of a really lovely Zen state.
Yep.
And, he's a guy who certainly, I mean, much like Bowie, I suppose, is his friend, just kept searching and does keep searching for new ways to do things and is never satisfied with what he's done or he may be satisfied with it, but he never feels that the idea is he has to repeat it.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is rock journalist par excellence, Jim Sullivan. And we're talking about his new book, Backstage and Beyond, 45 Years of Classic Rock Chats and Rants, Volume 1, Volume 2, coming out in October. Now, that said, you know, conversations with Brian Eno and Bowie are one thing. What I love is the fact that you included some real insane interviews that went off the rails, as far as I'm concerned. And I like it because, as a person who interviews people, that happens occasionally to me too. Talk about interviewing Jerry Lee Lewis, because I thought you were going to die in that one.
There was a possibility. I'm saying it in kind of a flip way, because I didn't. But Jerry Lee and I had a relationship from really about 1982 to 87. And for some reason, he got on with me, trusted me, talked to me pretty much after shows that he did in Boston or New Hampshire where I saw him. And so I had a whole lot of material over the years with Jerry Lee. And he was no surprise, a very provocative man who was torn between heaven and hell. The idea that when he died, he wanted to go to heaven, wasn't quite sure. Was he dragging his audience to hell with him with his music? Maybe. Thought he might be. Hoped he wasn't. He came back around again to say, I don't know. But the real sticky part, I guess, if you will, came after Rolling Stone had written a story that pretty much accused him of having at least something to do with the death of his wife at the time. And it was strongly written. It was written by a Pulitzer Prize winner, Richard Ben Kramer. And it left the impression that perhaps because Jerry Lee was in tight with the Louisiana police, they didn't really investigate it very much. They gave him a pass, and it was like, this is Jerry Lee. Okay. Well, I was the first interview he'd done after that story ran, and I knew I would have to bring that up at some point. And this was when we were in New Hampshire at the Club Casino, and after the show, I was going to be talking to him, and he said, well, you know, I've got to get to the airport. Can you ride in the limo with me to the airport, and, you know, we'll talk there. He was with his new girlfriend, and I said, sure, yeah, okay. So I had the people I went up to the show with follow the limo with the instructions of saying, if this limo stops, you stop. I may be not riding in that limo for the entire trip. I don't know. And because I knew I had to ask the question. And the answer is in the book. I don't want to give it away.
Yeah, exactly. Don't give it away.
What's that?
Don't give it away.
No, I won't. I won't. I will say he denied it. He certainly said he did not do it. I think when you read the chapter, and if you read between the lines of what he said and how he explained it, well, I think you'll come away with some doubts. I know I certainly did.
The other person, Ginger Baker, is my nightmare too, interviewing people. To interview a person who really doesn't want to be interviewed and basically doesn't care at all that you're talking to him.
Right. He was obligated by virtue of him doing a gig in Boston with his band, the jazz group he was with at the time. I guess the contract stipulated he'd do X number of interviews, and those interviews had to be a half hour each. I was one of them, and it was a pretty grueling half hour, probably for both of us, although he probably cared less than I did. But, yes, his attitude was, well, for one, he can't hear very well, so anything that I said, this is a phone interview, he was in England, and anything that I said, his first answer was pretty much, what? Because no, and I repeated it, and then he would kind of get there. But he wasn't one to pick up a question and run with it at all. He was one to pretty much snort at the idea of the question. It was dismissive, stupid, silly. Why are you asking that? And it was funny. I was debating whether to include that in the book or not, because in some ways it's my worst interview ever, and in some ways it's the most entertaining. And I've said this before to people. I said, look, it was tough for me. It was grueling for me to sit through, and but I think it's immensely entertaining for people on the outside.
Oh my God! If you're in the interview biz, It's this nightmare. It's like the dream you have about going to school naked or something like that. It's like, I don't want to be caught there.
Well, and the only, one thing at least I knew going in, because I'd seen the movie Beware of Mr. Baker, which everyone should watch. That too was just, terrific in portraying him as the curmudgeon. And that's the polite word that he was. And, so I knew going into it, this was not going to be an easy ride. The funny part was, in starting off, one of my, tactics, if you will, was to kind of let him know, oh, I know somebody who you've recorded with. Maybe this is a way into talking about it. He had recorded on a John Lydon record, or Public Image Limited record. He played drums on a couple of tracks. And I just, kind of innocently said, hey, I know one of the guys you worked with, John Lydon. And he just totally drew a blank, didn't remember it, didn't know it, didn't know Lydon. And it was sort of a stonewall of, maybe, I don't know. And so it started off with this immediate wall of, what are you asking me this for? What pertinence does this have to anything? And, we got into stuff like, when I'd ask him things about his heroin use, he would talk about, I asked him if it was debilitating. No, it wasn't debilitating. He used it for years, and it mostly worked for him until it didn't, So unlike most recovering addicts who, will say that it was not beneficial to their career, it was fine. He was like, now this is what I did for a long time, and it worked. So there are a lot of elements of that in that interview. And among the other things, too, are, asking about what other drummers he respects. And the answer is very, very few.
I run into this problem with visual artists, I'll tell you. And those are stories we'll share together over a beer. I want to talk about Marianne Faithfull just because I love her.
Sure.
And I love what she became, evolved into, because I was alive when it was, her hanging out with the Stones. And and then I remember when Broken English came out, that shocked the hell out of me. And it was great.
It was an amazing record. I mean, I knew her, like you, only from,
As Tears Go By. As Tears Go By.
Yes, Tears Go By, right, exactly. Very sweet voice, sweet, sad, bubbly, beautiful woman who emerged as, this damaged chanteuse, I guess, with this raggedy voice and these lacerating songs.
Why'd You Do It was, brutal.
Oh, it's the harshest breakup song ever, I think, and it's so evocative, so vivid, so vulgar. Well, I don't know. I mean, vulgar maybe, but boy, of course, and right to the point. And it brought her almost immediately, jettisoned her into the whole punk new wave post-punk framework of somebody who was an older artist, but whose music fit right into the zeitgeist of where she was at the time and where everyone else was at the time. So she was not viewed by anybody as sort of this anomaly or this ancient person from the 60s who had a couple of hits. She was, you know, right in the mix as somebody who, you know, was an important voice. And, of course, you know, as I write in the book, I mean, she had her troubles with drugs and alcohol, you know, she did her recovery at times outside of Boston, so I knew her a bit here when she was in town. But she also, you know, she came through it also very much, and was a lovely interview, you know, somebody I'm, you know, proud to have spent time with and really, really enjoyed all of it through the years.
But not a pop icon.
Oh, yes, that's right. Yes, sure. Yes, she hated that. She said, do not use that word to describe me. I'm still alive. I guess allowing for the fact that, all right, if I die, maybe you can use that. But no, she really hated that description.
We're almost out of time. We only just have a few minutes left. Let me ask you, what was your favorite Get interview? That you got it and you're so happy that you got that.
I guess probably Pete Townsend. Oddly enough, it was done in New York, and it was done to promote a book that he'd written called Horse's Neck. It wasn't done to promote The Who. At that point, The Who were over. He was very, he didn't look favorably upon what The Who had done. He was very self-critical and very articulate about being self-critical. And of his own songwriting, of virtually everything about it. So it led to a very in-depth discussion of The Who's history. I didn't know we would go deeply into it. We did. We also talked, of course, about the book. But it was just a case where, you know, he treats interviews as sort of therapeutic sessions. And there was a real...
That's how it read, yeah.
And it just I'll just tell you this. This is one of the fun things too. The way it started, he was one of the interviews where I admit I was a little bit nervous going into
it. We're almost out of time.
Oh, okay. So,
we could be talking about this book for years. And the second volume's coming out, so we're gonna definitely cover the second volume. My guest tonight has been rock journalist par excellence, and I mean that sincerely, Jim Sullivan, and we've been talking about his book, Backstage and Beyond, 45 Years of Classic Rock Chats and Rants, Volume 1, in which you learn that Lou Reed is, quote, a funny son of a bitch. Jim, it's been a pleasure. And again, we got to talk about Volume 2. I'm psyched about that.
Thank you, Mark. I look forward to that, too.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name's Mark Lynch. Good night.
I love a secret.